Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
My thanks to the great listeners who support this program. Let's name names. Faith Peoples, Cameron Troxell, David Pennell, Eugene Kenny. They all voluntarily subscribe to this program. And as we approach Thanksgiving, I'm doubly grateful to all the people who listen and all the people who contribute to support the Peter B. Collins Show. In our second segment today, we'll be joined by John Bonifaz, the co-founder and director of Free Speech for People. They're working to amend the Constitution to fix the Citizens United decision, allowing more corrupt corporate money to flow into our political candidates' elections. And that is a major irritant driving the Occupy forces around the country. Also, Will Durst will join us at the end of this podcast with his Thanksgiving expression of gratitude to the political turkeys who keep him performing and well paid all year long. And your humble host is going to take a little time off here around Thanksgiving and the following week. But I won't make you go cold turkey. Oh, I'm sorry. We've got some Boiling Frogs podcasts in the pipeline, and they will be posted over the next 10 days or so. And we will resume our regular podcast activity around the 5th of December. I am quite grateful to Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Washington, Occupy Oakland, the millions of people who have said they're not going to take it anymore. And it's not perfect. Nothing is. But this expression has changed the national conversation. And while it doesn't appear to have been a direct factor in derailing the super committee's work to cut the deficit in order to appease the radical extremists who want to dismantle our government, I really think that it's changed the national conversation. The term income inequality has showed up in the media, on television, and in print thousands of times since September. And it was barely discussed before that. And I want to thank the people who have put their lives on the line. From veterans who've been wounded on the streets of Oakland to an 88-year-old mom, grandmother, I think her name is Darley, pepper sprayed on the streets of Seattle. And it is perverse, but real, that the media and political leaders only pay attention when there is violence. And those who participate in this leaderless movement have largely sworn off violence. I'd say 99% of them. And it's to their credit. And in my comments today, I want to ask you to speak up. If you would just send one message to an elected leader, to a police chief, to a mayor, and express your opposition to the arbitrary and unnecessary use of force by cops all over the country. And this is now gelling around the focal point just up the road from me, the University of California at Davis. And if you don't know California, Davis is roughly halfway between San Francisco and Sacramento. Actually, it's a little closer to Sacramento. And Davis is an ag school, but there are a lot of activists there. There are a lot of progressive people. And we have seen over the past few weeks, as the Occupy protests have spread onto college campuses, that the campus security and police are as out of control as the New York police or the Oakland cops. And it's time that everyone in the United States pushes back and says no to a police state, no to excessive violence, no to the kind of authoritarian retaliation that we saw play out in the video that's just been released. A courageous soldier named Kayvon. He was trying to get away from the confrontation that the cops were staging in Oakland on November 2nd. And he's a guy, I think he did three tours in Iraq and one in Afghanistan. And he showed incredible courage. He was asking the cops to let him through their line so that he could leave the scene. And instead, they kept pushing him back onto the mean streets of Oakland that he wasn't familiar with. And he said, just let me go. Just let me go through here. I'll get out of here. And as he tried to talk with the cops, one of them got incredibly angry. It's very clear. And came running after him with his billy club. And clubbed this soldier, this veteran, repeatedly and unnecessarily, kept clubbing him when he was down on the ground. The soldier never fought back, never tried to attack the cop. But the cop was determined to show him. And Kayvon has a damaged or ruined spleen, many other injuries as a result. Now, at Davis, the videotapes have turned the campus police chief into a liar. Her name is Annette Spicuzza. She and a lieutenant who pepper sprayed nonviolent protesters who were seated on the ground, and another campus cop, apparently a fairly recent recruit, the three of them have been suspended with pay pending an investigation. And I want to thank Gary Chu. You know him as our film reviewer on the program. He forwarded me an email that was published on the 20th of November. And it's just signed, Students. And it makes 10 points that I'd like to review briefly for you here about what actually happened at Davis and how reality is captured on many video cameras, phone cameras. That evidence shows that the officials are not telling the truth. Number one, the protest at which UC Davis police officers used pepper spray and batons against unresisting demonstrators was an entirely nonviolent one. None of the arrests at UC Davis in the current wave of activism have been for violent offenses. Not one. No violence. No need for police to randomly spray pepper spray or mace or whatever chemical irritant they were using. And they did it so casually and gratuitously, like they were spraying that Halloween silly string stuff. And it was all just a yuck-em-up good time. Pepper spray hurts. They don't call it mace because it's a free moisturizer. Item number two. the unauthorized tent encampment was dismantled before the pepper spraying began. Students had set up tents on campus on Thursday. The administration allowed them overnight. When campus police ordered students to take them down on Friday afternoon, most complied. The remainder of the tents were quickly removed by police without incident before the pepper spray began. Now, here's the next point that's very important and directly contradicts the assertion of the police. Students did not restrict the movement of police at any time during the demonstration. If you've seen the video, the students were seated with linked arms. The cops were able to step over the seated demonstrators, and we've seen in the video they do that repeatedly. Yet now on leave, police chief of the campus cops, Annette Spacuzza, told the Sacramento Bee, "Officers were unable to leave the circle. There was no way out," she said. "They were cutting the officers off from their support. It's a very volatile situation." But the student's memo goes on, "Multiple videos clearly show that the seated students made no effort to impede the officers' movement. Indeed, Lieutenant Pike, who initiated the pepper spraying, was inside the circle moments later. And to position himself to spray this group, he simply stepped over that line of students." So it's bullshit. And here's a point, whether it's Tahrir Square or Bahrain or the University of California at Davis. The authorities can no longer make false claims. We now know that the Oakland incident, after they cleared the camp the first time and there was a confrontation on the streets, the cops claimed that rocks and bottles were thrown. The only evidence we've seen is that a couple of cops got spattered with paint. That's not a projectile. It's annoying, but it's not a projectile. It's not the kind of thing that is the basis to start gassing people. And the city of Oakland has a sordid history of police violence. They currently operate under a consent decree that requires the Oakland Police Department to limit the use of gas and pepper spray to very specific conditions that were not met in virtually all of the incidents that have occurred so far. Item 4 in the students from UC Davis memo, Lieutenant Pike was not in fear for his safety when he sprayed the students. And when you look at the videos, this is very clear. He's not operating in a defensive mode. He's taking advantage of these nonviolent students who are not moving, who are not challenging the police. They're simply holding their position as they're seated on the ground. And one of the videos shows Lieutenant Pike chatting amiably with an activist, even patting him casually on the back. Just 2 minutes and 19 seconds before he sprayed the student that he had been chatting with. Item 5. University of California police are not authorized to use pepper spray except in circumstances in which it is necessary to prevent physical injuries to themselves or others. And this situation clearly didn't even come close. UC police are not authorized to use physical force except to control violent offenders or to keep suspects from escaping. This situation did not meet those criteria either. The UC Davis police made no effort to remove the student demonstrators from the walkway peacefully before using pepper spray against them. That's right. They escalated against a group of people who were not escalating their aggression toward the cops. Item 8, use of pepper spray and other physical force continued after the students' minimal obstruction of the area around the police ended. Yep. And that is what really pushes it over the line. Item 9, even after the police began using unprovoked and unlawful violence against the students, they remained peaceful. And number 10, the students' commitment to nonviolence extended to their use of language. Good for them. Because I would have been hurling F-bombs at minimum. And I really commend the students for maintaining their composure in the face of what is essentially a police riot. And we're now seeing more detail on the coordination across the country. There is a group called PERF, the Police Executive Research Forum, an international non-governmental organization with ties to law enforcement, and they have been coordinating the conference calls that Oakland Mayor Gene Kwan apparently inadvertently disclosed to the public. They get money from Homeland Security, but DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, is trying to say that they're not directly involved in coordinating the crackdowns across the country. And when you look at this, how different is it from Syria? How different is it from Bahrain? I remember vividly this past summer that one of the members of the royal family of Bahrain said that the protesters who'd been injured by the police, every one of those instances would be investigated. That's what he said. And he looked at the camera and acted as if we're all supposed to believe that someone might be held accountable. And so now we have the chancellor of UC Davis saying she was appalled by the use of force. She's been listening to students. She has launched an investigation. Students will be involved. The report is due back in 30 days. The chancellor of the University of California, the entire system, has spoken up and said he is opposed to the excessive force that's been used at Berkeley and Davis. But these are the same people who direct the cops who use the pepper spray, who used batons to butt people when it was not required. And so, why should we believe that? And as I speak to you here on Monday, the 21st of November, Egypt is in turmoil again. People have repeatedly been in the streets over the last few days challenging the military government that has been ruling the country since Mubarak was ousted last January. And what's interesting is the military government responds to this huge demonstration first by cracking down, but then by actually resigning. Elections are due to be held in the next 2 weeks, and it will be very interesting to see what happens in Egypt. But listen to this. This is a quote from an Egyptian state television anchor on Sunday, as the violence in Cairo broke out again, and Egyptian authorities cracked heads and two people were killed. This anchor on Egyptian state TV said, "We saw the firm stance the Americans took against Occupy Wall Street people and the German government against green protesters to secure the state." So, the whole world is watching the United States. And while some people, I'm sure, are inspired by the courage of the protesters, we're seeing governments who are copying the action of the U.S. in these coordinated efforts to quash these demonstrations. And when billionaire Mayor Mike Bloomberg, who bought himself a third term by relaxing the term limits in New York City, announced that he had cleared Zuccotti Park because of health and safety issues, what a crock of shit that is. And the same thing in Oakland. Oakland and New York have public health issues all year long in public places, of trash that's not cleaned up, rats that run rampant. I mean, these are big cities. Likewise, both have serious problems with violence. Violence occurs on a daily basis in Manhattan. Violence occurs on a daily basis in Oakland. And yet the mayors and their respective police chiefs can look at the TV cameras and say, oh, yeah, we had to clear out those tents because it was a health issue. Yeah. We got to clear out those tents because it was a safety issue. We know how empty those words are. And we also know that not only this group PERF, but the Department of Homeland Security was set up with this in mind. DHS, and I hate the term homeland, and it brings up my retch reaction every time I say it. But when Bush cobbled together these various government departments to create the Department of Homeland Security and give it a huge budget, we knew then and we raised concerns that this police state apparatus would not just be used to protect us from them, the bad guys, the terrorists. No, it is to protect our government and our corporations from us. And I believe that we see a movement in this country that will not be stopped. And I don't think it's about camping out. I don't think it's about control of public places. I think it's about the control of our agenda, of the political debate in this country, and the urgent need to rebalance our economic system and to repair our political system. And I think our political leaders are generally clueless. And they think business as usual. You just beat up some protesters, you pepper spray them, and they'll go away because, hey, Black Friday's here and people are going to go shopping and Christmas is coming and people are going to forget about it. And then American Idol's going to kick off a whole new season. And who's going to care? Well, I think they have really misjudged this. I think we're seeing an uprising in the United States, an exercise of power by the people, really unprecedented in my lifetime, not even the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War, in my view, have this kind of potential.
We want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear. We as the young wish to say in this song, God bless great America. We give thanks to the old for achieving their goal. It is now up to us, and we know we must build up a trust. And we want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear. Power for the people. Power for the people.
That's my old friend, the late, great Curtis Mayfield.
Power for the people.
Next on the Peter B. Collins Show.
Some people say a man is made out of mud.
Is it time to amend the Constitution
muscle and blood
to correct
muscle
the damage done by Citizens United?
A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
Yeah, lots of politicians, elected officials in this country owe them, yep, they owe just about everything to the company store. They owe their souls to that company store. And Citizens United really helped a lot of people understand the dimensions of it. And at the same time, it unleashed millions, if not billions of dollars in corporate money that is now flowing into political campaigns. John Bonifaz joins us. He is the co-founder and director of Free Speech for People. John, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you, Peter. Happy to be with you.
And we've got a lot of work to do to drain the swamp and deal with the pervasive corruption in our political system. And I believe, even though there are many people who complain that Occupy Wall Street and its other movements connected around the country are a little too vague or nonspecific, but I really do feel that corporate power and the corporate influence in our political process is one of the building blocks of the Occupy movement.
No question about it. I mean, if you take a look at all the messages coming out of Occupy Wall Street and around the country, a principal underlying message is it's we the people, not we the corporations. The people, not corporations, shall govern in America. And I think the public is ready for this fight for a constitutional amendment, for a 28th Amendment that would make clear that corporations are not people with constitutional rights. And, in fact, now we have that amendment bill. Congressman Jim McGovern of Massachusetts introduced it on Tuesday, November 15th, the People's Rights Amendment, and it would restore democracy and the Constitution to the people.
And is this is the McGovern resolution explicit? Does it recommend, for example, that corporations I want a stronger language. Does it ban corporations from putting money into the political process?
What it does is it makes clear that corporations are not people with constitutional rights and therefore allows Congress and the states to rule over corporations and to effectively create those bans. Mm-hmm. So it makes it clear that we the people govern, not we the corporations. And so if Congress and the states want to create those kinds of bans with respect to corporate spending, they can now do so without the corporate sphere coming in to court and claiming a fabricated constitutional right that would strike down that kind of law, which is essentially what happened in Citizens United. Congress had passed a law barring corporate spending in elections, and in came corporate America into federal court and ultimately to the Supreme Court and got that law overturned, trumping American self-government of, for, and by the people and allowing this fabricated constitutional right to effectively supplant we the people.
And does the McGovern proposed language also fix the Supreme Court decision in Buckley versus Valeo?
That ruling, as you know, 1976 ruling that equated money with speech, is a different doctrine that needs to be overturned. This amendment does not address that. There is a separate amendment that would do so, and that's Senator Udall's amendment bill that would effectively allow Congress and the states to regulate campaign spending, either by corporations or by individuals, or you know, by candidates themselves, and that is an important step forward as well. There's no question that we need to deal with that money equaling speech doctrine, but we also must deal with this question of whether corporations are treated as people with constitutional rights and overturn that doctrine as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and tell me, John, how does the McGovern proposal match or differ from the language of the Senate proposal for a constitutional amendment?
Well, so the language of the, and again, you can find, people listening to your show can find this at peoplesrightsamendment.org or at freespeechforpeople.org, but at peoplesrightsamendment.org, it takes you right to the language. The language has three sections in the McGovern bill. Section one, we the people who ordain and establish this Constitution intend the rights protected by this Constitution to be the rights of natural persons. And then Section 2 deals with what the words people, person, or citizen means, and that it does not include corporations, limited liability companies, or other corporate entities. And then finally, Section 3 focuses on the fact that nothing contained in this amendment shall be construed to limit the people's rights of freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of association, etc. Now, with respect to Senator Udall's bill that has some senators on board with it, that amendment would deal, again, with the question of whether Congress and the states shall be able to regulate the spending of money in elections, whether it's from corporations or whether it's from individuals, whether it's from candidate campaigns, any kind of spending of money. And it deals with a different problem, an important problem, but that language does not address the corporate personhood issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so let me just ask you to repeat that. The Senate bill, the Udall proposed constitutional amendment, does not address the corporate personhood issue?
It does not, but again, it's an important step forward. It addresses the Buckley v. Valeo issue,
right.
The idea
okay.
that we cannot limit campaign spending. I mean, since 1976, we've seen this explosion in campaign spending because mandatory spending limits that have been passed in the wake of the Watergate scandal were struck down by the 1976 U.S. Supreme Court ruling in Buckley v. Valeo. So this amendment that Senator Udall has introduced would overturn that ruling and would make clear that Congress can enact mandatory spending limits, as could the state.
I see. Then we really need both of these constitutional amendments.
I think we need both of them. There's no question that we need to address the money equaling speech problem, and we need to address the corporate personhood problem. And, you know, if we look at our history in terms of constitutional amendments, Peter, we see that often in our history, these kinds of amendments have come coupled together or in threes. We saw the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, of course, happen more or less around the same time. We saw during the Progressive Era a number of amendments come around the same time. And so there's been this clustering of amendments, and this is a moment in our history where we need to defend and expand our democracy with the constitutional amendment process, and these are two key amendments to do that.
John Bonifaz, if you would, take a moment here to just help people understand the process, because a constitutional amendment was set up by the framers to be something difficult to achieve. And in fact, it is. At first, we have to get it approved by a two-thirds vote of each House of Congress. Am I correct?
That's correct.
And then the route forward is either a constitutional convention or ratification by two-thirds of the states. Is that right?
Well, the only correction I make there is you could have a constitutional convention that's a separate route entirely. But when you have passed it out of Congress, what's required there is for the states to ratify.
Okay.
Three-quarters of the states must ratify.
Oh, three-quarters.
That's
mm-hmm.
right. They can either ratify via state legislatures, or if they have a ballot initiative process in their state, they can ratify it that way. But the constitutional convention route is actually an entirely separate route. We actually have never used it to amend the Constitution. We only had one convention in our history, and that was in 1787. And it's difficult to know whether you could limit the subject of the convention solely to one matter. In other
yes.
words, you could open it to any kind of amendment in that process. You would still need to get three-quarters of the states to ratify any amendments coming out of the convention.
Mm-hmm.
But the focus that we have in this campaign is to use the route that we've used 27 times before in our history to amend the Constitution, and that's through two-thirds of the Congress passing it and sending it to the states for ratification.
Okay, so the supermajorities are two-thirds at the congressional level and then three-fourths at the state level.
That's right.
Okay. And those are significant hurdles, and particularly when we look at the current composition of the House and the Senate and of state houses across the country, we would need incredible buy-in from Republicans to pass either one of these proposed constitutional amendments.
Well, you know, we don't look at this in the short term. I mean, you're right that if we took this fight right now to Congress and tried to get it through two-thirds of the House and Senate, we would need a substantial number of Republicans and Democrats, obviously. But this is a movement that is beginning now, and I think we'll go beyond this two-year cycle that we're in, and we don't know what Congress is going to look like in 3, 4, or 5 years. We don't know what it's going to look like in 10 years. What we do know is that, as Senator Paul Wellstone has said, you cannot win a fight if you don't start it. And we need to start this fight for America, for the promise of American self-government, for our democracy, in order to win it. And, you know, this is a grassroots movement that we're working to build with groups around the nation. We're not focused as much on getting Congress to act right now as we are in getting states to express the public will that we want this amendment. So we're in states across the nation passing and calling for resolutions to be passed, calling on Congress to take this action. And I think that's how we're going to do it, building it from the grassroots up, a new movement for our democracy.
And as you look at this complicated picture, John, what steps do you want our listeners to take in the near term? What do you think we want to do to try to spread the word and get people activated around this issue?
Yes. Well, first, obviously, we'd love people to join us at freespeechforpeople.org. There are tens of thousands of people who are part of this campaign already. We'd love people who are listening to your show to join us at freespeechforpeople.org. Download our resolution. Take it to your local community group. Take it to your town meeting. Take it to your city council. Take it to your state legislature and work to get these resolutions passed, calling on Congress to take this action. Hold public events in your neighborhood, your community, that help educate people about this central question of our time. Write letters to the editor. Speak out on this question wherever you can. We have several videos on our resources page. Download some of those videos. Show it at a house party. Join this campaign in whatever way you can to help spread the word and mobilize a grassroots movement around the nation calling for a constitutional amendment to restore our democracy.
Now, John, I've been talking about Citizens United since the Supreme Court handed that decision down, but I felt that it really wasn't penetrating to the general public. And I was kind of pleased to see that one of the most frequent signs that I've seen carried by Occupy protesters and others who support them is, if corporations are persons, why hasn't Texas executed one?
Right.
And I think it's an amusing way to put it. But it shows that there is a growing awareness and a deeper awareness, not only of corporate control of our political process, but the explicit role that money in politics, corporate money, and the changes that Citizens United opens up. It appears that average people are much more aware of this. Is there any polling that you've seen that shows the level of knowledge about Citizens United and cash-in campaigns as well?
Yes. In fact, we've done some of that polling. So we enlisted Peter Hart and Hart Research Associates, who does polling for NBC News and Wall Street Journal, and has been engaged as a public opinion researcher for a number of years, very well respected. He took on this project for us to assess where is the public on the question of Citizens United and on the question of corporate constitutional rights. He found there was overwhelming opposition across the political spectrum to the Citizens United ruling and to the idea of corporate constitutional rights, and overwhelming support across the political spectrum for a constitutional amendment that would make clear that corporations do not have the rights of people under the Constitution. And we have that at our website at freespeechforpeople.org for people to see and download right from the homepage. 68% of Republicans, according to this survey, support a constitutional amendment that would make clear corporations are not people with constitutional rights. 82% of independents, 87% of Democrats. As dangerous as the Citizens United ruling is, it is also an historic opportunity for us to unite the nation around this common vision, government of, for, and by the people. People understand that at a fundamental level, and amendment fights are opportunities to return to this basic fundamental principle that it's we the people who govern, not we the corporations. And that's, I think, what's at stake here. You know, and I think that we have that opportunity because the nation is united around that basic principle that it's government of, for, and by the people.
Now, John, a few minutes ago I referenced that, you know, if we were trying to accomplish these in the near term, that we'd need a lot of Republican support. And after you just described the polling numbers, I certainly understand that citizens broadly know that we have a corrupt system and we need to fix it. But the constitutional amendment process here forces us to rely on the beneficiaries of this corruption to fix it. And to imagine that we can get a two-thirds vote in both houses of Congress to correct their own corruption, that seems far-fetched.
Well, it may to some people, but those people who think it's far-fetched aren't looking at our history, to be frank. I mean, women did not get the right to vote in this country because men in power thought it was a good idea. They organized, they fought, they died in order to get the 19th Amendment to the Constitution guaranteeing women the right to vote. You know, we have engaged in these kinds of fights throughout our history up against major odds where those in power, you know, were not on the side of making the change. And yet they were forced to make the change because the people rose up. And this is one of those examples where we have to demand this kind of change to unite the nation around this basic principle. And, you know, we may not see where those votes are going to happen right now out of Congress. But if we mobilize a grassroots movement around the nation, as we've done before in our history, for this kind of fundamental change, for this fundamental right, I think we will see that kind of vote happening out of Congress, and we will see this amendment being enacted.
Well, I would just add to what you said there that I think that since this is a long-term effort, I think one of the first steps is to elect people to Congress who will fix this system and who will commit to do that. I'm wary of these kinds of pledges that we ask candidates to sign, the Grover Norquist no tax increase pledge, and there's a pro-life pledge that a lot of Republicans sign. And I don't like pledges because I think that people have to be free to vote on a given issue based on the information before them at that time. That said, I think that this is a philosophical commitment that we should extract from those that we support for political office.
Well, I agree with you, and I would actually add to that that, you know, in terms of what your listeners can do, another key thing they can do is participate in the town meetings that happen when their members of Congress come back to the district and ask the basic question, where do they stand on the People's Rights Amendment, and to participate in pushing for these kinds of questions to be asked at debates, whether they be debates for a congressional race, whether they be debates for a Senate race, or even if there's a presidential debate in their region, to force the issue into the national debates that are happening because it's a 2012 election year upon us, and to allow this conversation to spread all around the nation, to say, where do people stand on this idea of corporations being treated as people, and where do you stand on a People's Rights Amendment being enacted?
Now, John, on a separate issue, and you may consider this to be somewhat extraneous to your focus, but Clarence Thomas, the Supreme Court Justice, who was the first beneficiary of the Citizens United group back when he was up for confirmation in 1991, Citizens United spent over $100,000 on TV ads that ran in the Washington market, which were anti-Anita Hill messages. And they were used to help push through the so-called high-tech lynching rhetoric that really was effective in getting Thomas confirmed to the court. And I think it's really important for people to understand that he did not recuse himself from the Citizens United decision.
Right.
And we now know from some very good journalism work that his wife, Virginia Thomas, has set up companies to try to benefit from this new infusion of corporate cash in political campaigns.
Right.
And the utter chutzpah that is demonstrated in that sequence of events where Mrs. Thomas is poised to benefit from the decision that her husband was the pivotal vote on and from which he should have recused himself. I think this is a really critical issue.
No question about it. I mean, you know, we require people who are judges in our society to be held accountable to the highest ethical standards. And what has emerged about Justice Thomas and his actions is frankly outrageous and needs to be fully investigated. There needs to be a full investigation as to what Justice Thomas knew, when he knew it, and what actions he took that may have crossed the line. And I think that standard needs to be applied to every Supreme Court justice. You know, these justices claim they don't need to be held accountable under the judicial code of conduct because, of course, the idea is that only applies to appellate court judges and district court judges. But there needs to be a standard to which the justices will hold themselves accountable. And it can't be some ad hoc standard that they just create. It needs to be a standard that is understood by all the people in the nation and that the highest court in the land is going to abide by that standard. And I think there's no question that Justice Thomas needs to be investigated for what has been revealed in terms of the way he's acted on this matter.
Well, we have a very interesting situation developing regarding recusals, because since the Supreme Court has accepted for its review the Obama health care reform law, the right wing, Republican talk shows, bloggers, and my email is just full of this on almost a daily basis, they are zeroing in on the former Solicitor General, now Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan, and some emails that she sent regarding the process and whether the votes were there or not for the health care reform. And so they're trying to paint her as an interested party who should recuse herself. And I think there's a valid question there. I haven't made a judgment on it, but I do think it's a valid a question to raise. But these same people turn a blind eye to the very clear conflict of interest that should have required Clarence Thomas to recuse himself.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's just not a consistency in the standard in any way. I think the fact of the matter is that we require, again, our judges, our justices, to have the appearance of fairness, appearance of impartiality. And, you know, even if you want to give the benefit of the doubt to Justice Thomas, that he didn't do anything wrong or he was not in any way in actual conflict with Citizens United, the appearance alone denigrates the process. The appearance alone undermines public confidence in our judicial institutions. And for that reason, he should have recused himself. So, you know, we're dealing here with, a standard that needs to go beyond actual conflict to appearance to do away with the kind of public confidence problems that emerge when you see now what's been revealed. People don't trust the court when they read about this. They don't believe that it's operating fairly. And that places the Supreme Court in a very dangerous territory. When you don't respect the institution to issue an impartial and fair ruling, then, you know, we really are undermining the entire democratic process.
John, I wanted to get your take on an interesting op-ed that was published in the New York Times on the 17th of November, written by Lawrence Lessig. He used to teach law at Stanford, and now he is at Harvard. And one of the things he enumerates that I found really interesting, less than 1% of Americans give more than $200 in a political campaign. No more than 0.05% give the maximum in any congressional campaign. A career focused on the 1%, or he says the half percent, will never earn them the confidence of the 99%. So this is an interesting parallel to the Occupy movement, and it illustrates the role of big money, large contributions, in political campaigns, and that they do really wag the tail of this dog. Lessig also has his own proposal to say no to corporate contributions, limit independent expenditures and soft money, and to put a flat $100 cash contribution limit on every American citizen, plus give them a $50 voucher for anyone who files taxes. And this democracy voucher could then be forwarded to the political campaign of that person's choice. I think it's very interesting. Tell me your thoughts, and then tell me how it fits in the legal frame.
Well, I think that it's a very creative proposal, and I think Lawrence Lessig is right about the problem of money in politics. I couldn't agree more with him on that. As I said, I think we need to deal with both problems. I think we need to deal with the problem of money in politics, but I also think we need to deal with the problem of corporations being treated as people and overturning corporate personhood. But as far as you know, engaging in creating a voucher system, that is effectively a way to create public funding of elections, and I fully support public funding of elections. I think that's needed to level the playing field. I just think in this post-Citizens United context, we need to be bold and broad in our vision, and that means a constitutional amendment fight that can serve as the engine for all these other reforms, but that returns us to that basic first principle of what we are as a nation, is that we the people are we the corporations. And, you know, a constitutional amendment is also going to be needed, frankly, to protect some of these reforms in light of where this court has gone in Citizens United and other campaign finance cases.
John, tell us who is partnering with your group, Free Speech for People. Move to Amend is a group that, as I recall, was started by David Cobb in Humboldt County, California here, the Green Party candidate for president back in 2004. Is Move to Amend aligned with you on this effort?
Well, we are aligned philosophically. We are often on the trail together in a number of states. We do collaborate from time to time. Move to Amend has a different strategy at times than we do, but there is a constellation of groups that are involved. People for the American Way, Public Citizen, Common Cause, Move to Amend is certainly one of them. And we work with all those groups. We do believe that there ought to be a singular campaign, as much as these multi-issue groups are needed, there ought to be a singular campaign that's focused only on this question of the need for a constitutional amendment, and that can transcend political ideology, that really can bring together people from across the political spectrum. So as much as I support a lot of the other progressive stances that these other groups take, including a living wage, getting us out of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, single-payer health care, I personally support all that. But I also believe that we can disagree with other people in the nation as to what kind of government policy should be enacted or whether even what kind of government we should have. But we can agree that government is of, for, and by the people, and we can gather together around that common vision. And that's why I think there's a value, in addition to the multi-issue groups, to having this singular campaign of free speech for people that focus on this amendment fight all the way.
Well, John, I thank you for taking this on, and I fully support what you're doing. I'm going to put up a link to freespeechforpeople.org with the show information so people can link over to your site and see what's going on there. And please keep us posted on your progress. This will be a long haul, and we'll be happy to support you every step of the way.
Peter, thanks so much. We really appreciate it.
And now, San Francisco's stand-up political comic and sit-down satirist, Will Durst, shares his thoughts about the Thanksgiving turkey holocaust. Take it away, Will.
Hey, guys. Will Durst here in my guise as a 40-foot helium balloon to kickstart our national parade of giving thanks. That's right. Turkey Holocaust Day is right around the corner. And to be honest, a little tryptophan poisoning might be the perfect antidote to trying times like these. Especially comforting when you consider that this holiday isn't about greasing the wheels of capitalism with the fire hose of consumer debt, like that other holiday about a month down the road which shall remain nameless. This one doesn't hide under any religious robes either. It's purely about gluttony, food, family, friends, and football. Four of the five F's. So allow me to express my gratitude for the fourth Thursday of November, one of the little things that makes life worth living. And here's some other examples of what a middle-aged, round-headed political comic gives thanks for. For Dick Cheney, six heart attacks, and the man goes on a book tour. How does a guy without a heart have six heart attacks? It would be like Rick Perry contracting a brain tumor. For Rick Perry, who suffered a 53-second brain freeze on national TV. 53 seconds. It only took the Niners 8 seconds longer to score 2 touchdowns last Sunday. The Niners. For Bill Clinton, who refuses to go away. God bless him. For Michelle Bachmann and her Newsweek cover shot, which made her look spooky. Her supporters complained that they cherry-picked a spooky photo on purpose, so the magazine put the entire photo shoot online, saying, "Which one would you have picked?" And they all shut up. For Pat Robertson, who said that the Republican presidential field is too extreme. Pat Robertson said that. It's like having your drug intervention hosted by Lindsay Lohan, and Charlie Sheen is driving the van. For Barack Obama, because no matter what you think of his policies, you got to admire his ability not to get involved in them. And finally, for George W. Bush, who established a think tank. Let me repeat that, the George W. Bush think tank. You can't make stuff up like this. See? Life is good. For the Peter B. Collins Show, I thankfully remain Will Durst.
And repeat after me, corporations are not people. Corporations are not people. Corporations are not people. Corporations are not people.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling underneath.